on Friday mornings, a small number of us from the church meet together to pray, just three or four men. And each week a different man leads that prayer meeting. And on Friday last, Stephen led the prayer meeting and he asked us all to go round and think of something for which we were grateful. I'm not saying this to put you off and make sure that none of the men here ever come to that meeting, but sometimes someone asks a big group of people to go around and everyone to participate, and you're sitting there thinking, oh, what am I going to say when it's my turn? Can't think of anything, which is silly. How can I not think of something I'm grateful for? God's given me everything I have. I can be grateful for everything. I just have to pick one, don't I? But you're thinking, okay, well, what can I say? What have I actually genuinely felt particularly grateful for this last week? I didn't say, but one of the things I could have said was I'm grateful for the sun. It's just an enormous blessing, isn't it? It's shining out there now and it's nice. I can see it reflecting off the leaves. They look green. They look beautiful. Summer is lovely and it's nice to enjoy the sun in summer. The evenings are getting later at the moment. And it's great. Such an enormous blessing. Maybe we don't think about the sun quite enough. God made the sun. And he made it to show us something of what he's like. We sang Isaac Watts's version of Psalm 19 just a moment ago. The heavens declare God's glory, the psalm says. In the heavens God set the sun. And the sun runs like a strong man running a race from one end of the heaven to the other end. And there's nothing hid from its heat. The sun is just big and strong and powerful. It's a created picture. It's something God has made to show us something of what he's like, something of his glory. It shines and we see everything by it. It gives life to the whole world. The plants wouldn't grow if there was no sun. The planet would just be a lifeless lump of ice with no sun. And you can't hide from it. No matter where you go, you will feel the heat of the sun. It shows us something, at least, of what God's like. He gives light. He gives life. There's no escaping him. And this evening, we're going to look at the occasion when Jesus said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." We're going to think a little bit about that saying. It's one of seven I am sayings in John's Gospel, very well-known sayings which John recorded for us. Seven of them, "I am the light of the world," is one. That leaves us with six. What are the other six, O children? Vicky. That's two more, yep. "I am the good shepherd. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world." That's three. David, your hand was up as well. "I am the gate," or the door, yes, depending on your translation. That is another one. John? I am the resurrection and the life. And "I am the vine." That is six. One more. Hannah, is your hand up? "I am the way, the truth, and the life." That's all seven. Very good. Complete set. But this week we're looking at "I am the light of the world." And we're going to do two things. First, we're going to look at when and where Jesus said this, because that matters very much. That is actually very important for understanding what he was talking about. And secondly, we're just going to pick out some of the words from that phrase and think about them. Three words from that phrase and think about them more closely. So look at when and where he was and then just pick out some of the words. Firstly then, when and where. Where was Jesus when he said this? When he said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Where is he? Genuine question. You can answer that. Vicky, where is he? Sorry? It's somewhere near the Mount of Olives, but it's not the Mount of Olives. It would be a short walk to the Mount of Olives. John. He is in the temple. The last verse we read, these words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. He was in the temple at the time. Second question then, and a bit harder maybe. When was it? I don't mean what time of day, I mean what time of year. That was in a bit we read as well, David. Well, you're thinking along the right lines. You're thinking of the Jewish festival year, but it was not the Passover. Josiah?
Like near Easter, before his death.
It wasn't... No, it wasn't just before his death, and it wasn't around Easter time either. No more takers? I'll relent. I'll give you the answer. The first verse we read was John 7:37, and John says it was the last day of the feast, the great day. So we know it's a Jewish feast, and we know it's a Jewish feast that goes on for more than one day. But at the beginning of chapter 7, you have to read back a little bit. John tells us that Jesus was going about in Galilee, didn't want to go to Judea, down in the south where Jerusalem was, because people were looking to kill him. But the Jewish Feast of Booths was at hand, the Feast of Tabernacles. His brothers asked him if he was going to Jerusalem for the feast, and he said, I'm not going, at least not publicly. And then later he went secretly in private. But on the last day of the feast, he revealed himself and stood up in the temple and cried out, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. This is still the Feast of Tabernacles. John 8 carries on from John 7, the way that chapter 8 usually does, from chapter 7. And John tells us then in chapter 8 that Jesus is still in the temple, still teaching there. 8:12, again Jesus spoke to them, I am the light of the world. He's still there, still talking to the crowd, still on the last day of the feast, the great day of the feast. Why does that matter then? He says, I am the light of the world. How? Why should we care when he said it? Isn't it just true? Whenever he said it. I think it does matter. I think it means something particular if you say it at Tabernacles, in the temple, this time of year and that place. Tabernacles is one of three big festival occasions in the Jewish year. Our years tend to be structured around big holidays, don't they? We have summer holidays and we have Christmas and we have Easter, and our years go round and round that cycle. And those are things we look forward to, things that we mark the passing of time with. And the Jews, it worked similarly, but their festivals were all explicitly religious and explicitly linked to temple worship. And Tabernacles was one of three big occasions when all the Jews, every good Jew, was supposed to go up to Jerusalem and celebrate in the temple. And Tabernacles was probably the biggest, the most exciting of the Jewish festivals. Like Christmas, I suppose, but Christmas in nice weather. Tabernacles is a harvest festival, so it's happening around the end of September, middle of October, something like that time. It's sunny, harvest's just over, so there's plenty of food, there's plenty of drink, even if you're tightening your belt the rest of the year at Tabernacles, there's more than enough to eat. And it's just exciting. Everybody's supposed to go up to Jerusalem for this feast. Everybody's supposed to gather. I'm sure not everybody does every year, but lots of people do. So the city is buzzing, it's heaving, filled to capacity. Every street, every square is going to be crowded. It will be noisy. And in a time when you don't have telephones or email, Maybe the only time you see certain friends is at the big festival occasions, when you all gather in the same place, when you all gather in Jerusalem. So people are talking to each other, talking to distant family, exchanging news, swapping rumours. Aunts and uncles and cousins and nieces and nephews, they're all getting together, talking about the events of the day. And part of the festival, part of the Feast of Tabernacles, is that you live in tents for the week, which is very exciting, especially if you're a child. You live in a booth, a tabernacle, a tent. That's why it's called the Feast of Booths, Feast of Tabernacles. Even if you live in Jerusalem and you have a house there, you still build a shelter of some kind, probably on the roof of your house. The houses have flat roofs. And you camp out for the week, which the Jews are supposed to do because that's a reminder to them of the Exodus. Tabernacles looks back for them, back to the time of Moses, when God delivered the nation out of Egypt and they went through the desert to the promised land and they lived in tents. They camped through that journey. And the Jews of Jesus' day are looking back, saying, this is where we came from, this is our fathers, they used to do this. We're reenacting what God did at the time of the Exodus. The temple itself at Tabernacles time would be packed. That was where things were happening. Every day of the feast, it's a week long, this feast, and every day different things happen in the temple. Ceremonies are going on. So every day in the temple, a great pot of water is poured out, carried into the temple and poured out. And the people are supposed to see that and remember how God gave them water in the wilderness, water from the rock in the days of Moses. They look back to that. And they look forward as well. They look forward to a time when all the work's over, when the full harvest is gathered in, when it's time for rest. And when God's mercy flows out from Jerusalem like rivers of water into the whole world, like the rivers of Eden flowing out of Eden to water the earth. And Jesus, when he stands up in the temple on the last day, the great day of the feast, and cries out, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture had said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." He's taking up that sort of imagery, isn't he? He's looking at what's happening in the temple. He's looking back to the Exodus. He's looking forward. And he's using that to tell the people about himself, to say, I am the reality of all of that. I am what the rock in the wilderness was pointing to. I give water to my people. I satisfy their thirst. I give them life. I'm what they need. And when he says, I am the light of the world, he's doing the same thing again. He's doing something very similar. He's taking up things that are going on in the temple during the Feast of Tabernacles, things that look back to Israel's past and that look forward to the future of the people of God. I'll read, in fact, from a Jewish account of how Tabernacles was celebrated in Jesus' day. People went down into the court of the women, where precautions had been taken to separate the men from the women. Very important for Jews, of course. Golden lamps were there, and four golden bowls were on each of them, and four ladders were by each. Four young men from the priestly group of youths had jugs of oil in their hands, containing about 120 logs. A log was a measurement of oil, about half a pint. So you've got these lamps, and each lamp has four bowls, golden bowls. So bright, shiny bowls on it. And they're high up, these bowls, high up off the ground. You have to go up ladders to get to them. And young men, four ladders around each lampstand, because there's four bowls, and four young men going up each ladder with sort of 60-pint jugs of oil in their hand, filling the bowls of oil. Wicks were made from the discarded trousers of the priests and from their girdles. So these bowls They're not just little things that you'd float a little bit of string in for a wick. You get an old pair of trousers that the priests don't wear anymore, and you twist the trousers together, and you put that in your sort of bathtub of oil on the top of this lampstand, and you use that as your wick. There was no court in Jerusalem that was not bright from the light of the place. Men of piety, and known for their good works, danced before them with torches in their hand, and sang before them songs and praises. And the Levites stood with zithers and harps and cymbals and trumpets and other musical instruments without number on the 15 steps which led down from the court of the Israelites into the court of the women. And you've got this going on every evening during the Feast of Tabernacles. You've got these huge lampstands full of oil blazing, which get lit by these priests. You've got men of piety singing and dancing in front of the lampstands. You've got the Levites on the steps playing these musical instruments without number. I don't know, maybe that sounds more like bonfire night than anything else in our experience. But bonfire night with singing and dancing and instruments. And the rabbis say that the dancing and the singing would go on all night, from dark until sunrise. So Jerusalem in October, it gets dark about 6:30, maybe. And it's going on until sunrise. And the faithful, the rabbis say, will try to stay awake every night of the feast. So Jesus is speaking in the temple at the time of Tabernacles. He's speaking outside the treasury in the court of the women, where this is going on. And around him there will be huge lampstands, whether they're lit or not when he speaks, we don't know. We don't know what time of day it is. But massive things. You have to climb up ladders to get to them. They're filled from 60-pint jugs. The wicks are twisted up pairs of trousers. And people say there's not a court in Jerusalem that isn't bright with the light. I suppose we live in quite a bright world, don't we? If I go outside at 3 in the morning, I don't, but if I did, it wouldn't be pitch black outside, would it, where I live in Edgeley? There would be street lights and car headlamps. But if I go out into the countryside, 7 miles from nowhere and beyond, far from the towns, far from the villages, far from the places where there's artificial light, it can get pitch black on a cloudy night. It can get so dark that you can't see your hand in front of your face. And most of the people, I should think, living in Israel would know what that kind of darkness was like. They didn't have electricity. They didn't have electric lights that they can just flick on with a switch. They have fires and oil lamps, flickering and smoky. But in Jerusalem, at the Feast of Tabernacles, you have these huge torches and they blaze and they light up the whole city. There's hardly an open space in the city where you can't see them, where there's no light. And this would be something they'd only see in Jerusalem, that sort of display, only at Tabernacles time. When Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," he says it in the temple, he says it at Tabernacles time. People are going to make the connection, aren't they? They're going to think, huh, the light's in the temple. Maybe he's talking something about that. And the lights in the temple, just like the water, they look forward and they look back. Or maybe the other way around, they look back and they look forward. The lights lit at the feast were meant to point to things. Back in the day, back in the days of Moses, the escape from Egypt, the Exodus, the Israelites have to make this long and difficult journey through the wilderness, don't they? They're travelling through unknown territory, don't know where they're going, they don't have a map to show them which way to go, they don't have a compass to show them which way is which. The whole nation is making this journey. There's a huge number of people, men and women and children. And sometimes they have to travel by night. And they're in the wilderness. There is no light. How do they do it? Read Exodus and you will see. In fact, there is a light. God himself was their light, the people in the wilderness. God came to them as a pillar of fire and cloud, a huge column of flames, lighting up the wilderness all around, showing them the way they should go. They were supposed to follow the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud. It would keep them safe, daytime and nighttime. It would make the nighttime day for them. It would make their pathway plain. These people are walking along, and without that pillar, it would all be black. They'd be tripping over, they'd be stumbling, they'd be going wrong, they'd be walking around in circles, they'd be clueless, they'd be hopeless, helpless. But the pillar of fire, God himself with them, gives them hope and light and comfort, reassurance. And at Tabernacles, people light the lamps and they remember the days in the wilderness. They remember when God was the light of his people. I'm having technical problems here. Having said I wouldn't, I now am. I'm going to have to continue the way some people sing without any real notes, so I do apologise if I forget what I was going to say or if I go badly wrong. Tabernacles. And looking back, people were supposed to look back to the way God had led his people in the days of the wilderness, to the way he had cared for them, guided them through the darkness. And they were supposed to look forward as well, not just back, but forward. We read earlier from Isaiah 60. This prophecy of Isaiah, he's writing 800 years maybe before Jesus. And he says, there will come a time for God's people, for Israel, when light dawns upon them, when the glory of the Lord rises on them. Darkness will cover the earth, thick darkness covers the peoples, but on Israel, on God's people, light will dawn, glory will be seen on them. And he goes on and says, the sun won't be your light by day, nor for brightness shall the moon give you light, but the Lord will be your light. The Lord will be your everlasting light and your glory. Your sun won't go down, your moon won't withdraw itself. The Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of mourning will be over. God will give you light and life and joy. Your people shall be righteous. They shall possess the land forever. The least one of your people shall become a clan, a mighty nation. Isaiah is holding out future hope for the people of Israel, and part of that hope is that God himself will be their light. They won't need the sun, they won't need the moon. God will shine upon them. That language of God as light is just so prevalent in the Bible, isn't it? They sing about it. Psalm 27, they sing that the Lord would be their light. Aaron's high priestly prayer, may the Lord lift up the light of his countenance upon you and give you peace. John picks it up later in Revelation, in the last chapter of Revelation, talking about the city of God, where the Lamb is their light. And Jesus and the people at Tabernacles, they're not supposed to just be looking back to the Exodus, they're supposed to be looking forward to the future. They're looking to a time when the pillar of fire and cloud will be made perfect and complete and universal, when the whole world will have God for their light. The whole world will be looking to him. He'll deliver them out of darkness. So that's where Jesus is when he says this, and that's the time at which he says this. We'll start to look at what he actually says then, and we'll pick out three words from this statement he makes. I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but we'll have the light of life. We'll think about the word light and about the word world and then about the word follow. Light, world, and follow. First, he says, I am the light of the world. And he is picking up, as we've said, on all this tabernacle's imagery. God as the light of his people. Think for a moment what it would be like just never to know light at all. If you were born blind, what would life be like for you? If you met someone born blind, how would you try to describe anything to them? If you said to them, there's an amazing sunset over there, look at it all, purple and orange, it's beautiful. How would they even understand what you meant? How would they know anything of what you're talking about? If someone's born blind, if they don't even know what it is to see, to look at anything, if they've lived in darkness their whole life, they're just ignorant of so many things that we know are there. We know what a sunset looks like. We know what it's like to climb a mountain and look down and see the green fields and the blue lakes underneath you. We can look at a tree in a field and see it old and gnarly and textured and lovely. And those things are real. But how do you describe them to someone born blind? How do you make someone born blind feel the way you're feeling about looking at those things? It's impossible, isn't it? You can't do it. When Jesus says, I am the light of the world, I suppose the first thing he means is that the world needs light. The world is lost in darkness. The world is full of people who are just born blind. They don't see, and it's not that they can't see light with their eyes, it's that they don't see the most important thing there is to see. The world is full of people who are blind to God, who just don't see him, don't think of him, don't understand even what it would mean for there to be a God. They're blind, they're in darkness, they're covered by thick darkness. And how can you reach those people? How can you explain to them what God is like? They don't understand what you're saying to them as you're talking. You can say God is holy, God is beautiful, God is good, God is kind, God is just. But they don't have any idea of what God is. They can't see. Their eyes are closed. To the things that are true, the things that are plain, the heavens declare God's glory. God's glory is obvious to everybody living in this world, to everybody who has a set of eyes. But it's not obvious to everybody because some people just don't see it. Some people are blind. Jesus is saying, I am the light of this world. I am the one who can open the eyes of the blind. I am the one who can show people what God is like, who can show them the things that really matter. A chapter later in John 9, Jesus will repeat exactly what he said in the temple. He sees a man who is blind from birth. And his disciples ask him about the man. And Jesus says, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And having said that, he spits on the ground and makes mud with the saliva and anoints the man's eyes with the mud and tells him to go and wash in a pool. And he washed and came back seeing. Jesus is the one who can bring sight to the blind, the people who live in thick darkness, the people on whom God's glory has not arisen, the people who just don't see anything about God. They need Jesus Christ. They need him to open their eyes. They need him to show them what God is like. And Jesus says, I am the one who can do that. I am the light. Just as God was with his people in the wilderness, blazing before them, showing them the way, showing them where to go, keeping them safe. I am that for my people. I show them the truth. I keep them safe. They can walk in the light of life if they follow me. He is the light of the world. And then the word world I am the light of the world. That's quite an astonishing thing for him to say, isn't it? That's quite a claim. If a man stood up and said, I am the light of the world. If President Trump were to call a press conference and stand there and say, I am the light of the world, we'd laugh at him, wouldn't we? We'd think this man is just so full of himself. But we don't laugh at Jesus when he says it. Why not? Because on the face of it, what he says is pretty ludicrous, isn't it? Here's this one man. He's the son of a carpenter. He grew up in Nazareth, middle of nowhere. He's never been more than 100 miles from his home. And he's claiming to be light of the world. Of the whole world, the world. I mean, Israel. Even if he said, I am the light of Israel, well, there's hundreds of thousands of people in Israel who don't believe in him, who don't think he's the light of Israel. But he claims to be the light of the world. And Israel is just tiny. It's insignificant in terms of world politics of the time. Israel is part of this vast Roman Empire, and it's just some little dingy backwater of the empire. And beyond the empire, there's a bigger world outside that. If the Roman emperor said, I am the light of the world, we'd think that was hubris, wouldn't we? We'd think that was ridiculous. Of course you're not the light of the world, you're just a tyrant who rules half of it. But Jesus, who has no country following him, commands no armies, has no political authority, he can stand in the temple and say, I am the light of the whole world. C.S. Lewis famously said, you have three options when it comes to Jesus. I could give you the exact quote if I had the screen, but I don't, so I can't, so I'll have to do it from memory. When you look at the things Jesus said, the claims he made about himself, stuff like, I am the light of the world, either he's just a complete lunatic, on a level with a man who says, I'm a poached egg, or he's worse than that, he's a liar. He is in fact the devil from hell, he is a big liar, he's making huge claims and they're just not true and he knows it. Or he is who he says he is, and what he says is true. Either what he says is true or it's false. And if it's false, he either knows it's false or he doesn't know it's false. So those are your three options. He's mad, or he's wicked, or he is the Son of God. He says, I am the light of the world. What do you think is the truth about that? Do you think he really is? Do you think he is the Son of God? It's a huge claim. Are you going to call him a liar? Are you going to call him mad? Or are you going to kneel and worship him? Those are your three. And thirdly, the word follow. I'm the light of the world. Light, world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. This promise he makes is conditional, isn't it? He says, I am the light of the world. But he doesn't mean that just everybody who lives in the world will be lit up, regardless. Everybody will have light, light for all. He says it's those who follow me who won't walk in darkness, but who will have the light of life. The people who don't follow him will keep walking in darkness. They won't have the light of life. What does he mean when he says, follow me? Again, think back to the Exodus. Think back to the Israelites in the wilderness. There's the pillar of fire. It's moving ahead of them, showing them the way they should go. What should they do? They should follow. They should walk after the pillar. They should go the way it leads. They should use the light that the pillar is blazing out to show them, to light the way for them. They should use it to see everything else by. They should walk in the way it goes. It's those who follow Jesus who don't walk in darkness, but who have the light of life. He is talking about Christian conversion, isn't he? This is what it means to be a Christian. It means to follow Jesus. I think people can be confused about that. You can get people who think maybe there's something in some of the things that Jesus says. Maybe when he talks about the world being in darkness, he's right about that. I mean, you can read the newspapers, can't you? You can see the things that were going on in London earlier. There's a lot of darkness in the world. There's a lot of wickedness. There's people doing terrible things. And maybe people think, well, okay, the world's dark. But in order not to be dark myself, in order to walk in light myself, what should I do? And some people think, well, I can just turn over a new leaf, can't I? I can just try to stop being dark myself. I can try to erase the darkness out of my own heart. I can just try to do better, try to be nicer. Try to change myself. I can reform. I can somehow generate some light within my own heart. And Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Follow me. The world is in darkness, and there's nothing we can do about that. There's nothing we can do to change it. We can't make ourselves light. We can't make ourselves different. We are people who are born blind. We are people born with no knowledge of God, with no love for God. And we can't generate that within our own hearts. We can't just command ourselves to be light and expect it to change anything. What we need to do is to look at Jesus, to look at his light, and to follow him. Look at the light of the world. Christian conversion, becoming a Christian, isn't about trying to reform yourself morally, trying to make yourself better. Becoming a Christian is about seeing the Lord Jesus Christ for who he is. It is about looking at him, seeing his glory, his beauty, his kindness, his wisdom, his power, seeing him as the Son of God, the one who came down from heaven to bring light into the world. Becoming a Christian is about looking at him and seeing the truth about him because he opens your eyes to see it. It's about starting to love him, starting to follow him, starting to serve him because he is the light and because we know we need the light. Becoming a Christian is about Jesus Christ in the end. It's about looking at the light of the world. Jesus came into the world to be the light of the world.